Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. And this week we're going to do another of our book podcasts focusing on a new novel by Jennifer Haig called Faith. But first we'd like to introduce our guest today, Kevin Spinelli, a Jesuit scholastic from the New England province. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
Kevin is here this summer at America interning, and we thought we would take that chance to talk about a novel that is getting some coverage in the Catholic press, and rightly so. It's about Kevin, the sexual abuse scandal from 2002. Maybe you can give a little more detail for our listeners.
One of the characters at the center of the book is a Boston Archdiocesan priest named Arthur Breen, who is accused of molesting a young child, the grandson of his housekeeper. And so it takes place in the spring of 2002, right after the sex abuse really broke in Boston, led by the Boston Globe in January, and the long Lent that followed. And the bulk of the novel takes place right around Easter 2002.
And the narrative device that the novelist used here is that it's told from the perspective of Father Art's sister Sheila, who's kind of trying to piece together what exactly happened, and that gives it an almost a detective story kind of feel.
Right, she's learning as she's putting the account together. She's piecing things that she finds from letters, from conversations with other characters after all the events of the story takes place. So she's learning as she's telling. She's also learning about herself, too, the narrator. Learning a lot about her family, her mother, her father, her younger brother, Michael, and especially about her half-brother, Arthur. She also inserts herself quite a bit, her point of view in characters, especially with Arthur, and trying to understand what his loneliness was like as a priest. Also his education and why he went to St. John's Seminary at age 14.
Which sounds ridiculously young to us, but was probably not that unusual back in that time. Before we go on, I just want to let folks know we're going to try not to give away any major plot points here, so if you're interested in reading the novel, you can still listen and do that. One parallel you draw, Kevin, is Sheila is trying to investigate her own family history and bring certain secrets to light. There's a parallel there with what the church was going through at the same time and trying to kind of reckon with its past.
Right. At one point in talking about her family, she uses the term canon of approved stories. In the Boston Archdiocese, there was a canon of approved stories. Namely, there was no such thing as child sexual abuse by priests. And if there were cases, it was not widespread. It was not an archdiocesan problem. But forced by the media and the faithful in Boston, the church was forced to address, Cardinal Law was forced to address the issue. And it was done in the worst way. It was just brought out into the press case by case. So it as much as it wanted, the archdiocese wanted to keep all these cases undisclosed, they were disclosed as through the media.
So Sheila, it wasn't entirely clear to me what she was up to with trying to put together this narrative. Is she trying to create some kind of document to maybe for her nieces or nephews to give them kind of the truth about what really happened?
I think so, because the way the story ends for Art, it's public shame. So for Sheila, who loved her brother Arthur and began to know him after his story sort of concluded, she wanted to pass along some account, some true account of what really happened with Arthur, with the entire family, even with her mother, and her own childhood, her own early marriage and loss of her first husband. And so, yeah, as much as she was creating a document, and I think that was a true, accurate account of her brother and her family, she was also, it was also a device for healing for herself, I think, and probably provoked changes in her own life and in relationships for her.
I couldn't help but thinking while I was reading this, I said, I know she's trying to do her family a service by putting this narrative together, but if she actually ever published this or circulated among her family, her mother would probably drop dead.
Right.
Yet
right.
It reveals some pretty dark secrets. You lay out here, which I think is very helpful, the sets of relationships in the book. Why don't we talk about a couple of those? One is between, and you just mentioned it, Father Art and his half-sister Sheila. What things do they share? Because they're pretty close as siblings.
We're getting the account of Art through Sheila. So it's her point of view, and the character is constructed through her. But the main thing that Art and Sheila share is loneliness, a fear of intimacy, a fear of emotion, even hugs and kisses, handshakes, any familial display of affection. She recognizes in Art a loner, somebody who likes to live alone, somebody who's used to being alone. And she herself is the same. After a very brief marriage, she is resigned to the fact that she will be a loner, living alone for the rest of her life. And she can't fathom any change in that, whether it is taking a child into her life, or even a husband, or a serious relationship. Because that would mean she would have to alter her life, her living arrangements.
Now, you also mentioned that they both share a fear of the water, and that's a theme that runs through this book.
Yeah. Arthur's family, it's a blending of the McGanns, who are Ted McGann is Sheila's father and Michael's father, and the maiden name of their mother, Divine. Her family had a number of drownings. Her grandfather drowned. So there, through her mother, both Sheila and Arthur have always had a fear of water. Whereas Michael, her brother, her father Ted, could dive out in Scituate Harbor off a boat, no questions asked. You know, there was no fear in them of that. They just did it. It was ordinary to them. Yeah, so water figures very importantly, and there are two beach scenes that are very important. One, when Arthur is sort of taking the place of a father and a family, and one from the past where Arthur is the child and Ted McGann, his mother's husband-to-be, takes him to the beach and sort of discovers Art to be a scared kid, a very, you know, dainty kid, not like the other kids who just run out to the ocean and dive in.
Another set of relationships you talk about is between Art and his half-brother Mike, and I thought this was particularly interesting. Somebody who went into the priesthood at age 14 versus somebody who was kind of athletic, handsome. Maybe you'd talk about that relationship.
I think throughout the book there's a sort of a tension between an ordinary guy and a peculiar guy, sort of a priest, somebody who's not married, doesn't have any kids, sort of lives alone in a rectory, wears funny clothing, just sort of isolated by virtue of who he is as priest and the vows or promises that priests make. From the beginning, even like the history of the Archdiocese in Boston, you have Cardinal O'Connell, who is this sort of majestic figure, this cardinal that ruled the Archdiocese with all pomp and circumstance. So sort of an odd man, peculiar man, not like the regular guy who succeeded him, Richard Cardinal Cushing, who everybody recognized as a guy's guy. Somebody wasn't afraid to have a beer or go, you know, out with the guys or toss a football. And Arthur sort of falls along the peculiar side as priest, as somebody who likes to sing, somebody who likes to read newspapers in Italian, read books, and does nothing athletic. In fact, he's sort of afraid of the athletic types as he's growing up, and seminary is a refuge for him. Whereas the brother is an ordinary guy, went into the Navy, excels, became a police officer, excels at selling real estate later on, you know, just a success story. Has three kids, beautiful wife, everything is going great. He keeps himself in shape. He's a guy's guy. And there's a constant juxtaposition between these two characters throughout the book. And toward the end, the conclusion, we see just how similar they are in their actions, ultimately.
It's interesting, too, how the two of them struggle with their sexuality in terms of how to deal, in the case of Michael, with kind of some strong appetites. In the case of Arthur, it's something that was really not part of his formation at all. You said he went into the priesthood at age 14, and he writes about having, it was not a big part of his life. This temptation was never real for him, but it's something that he has to grapple with. So that's an interesting tension there. And I should mention that there are some questions that Sheila, for example, considers. And Mike, too, is Father Art homosexual? And it's something they're not sure of. But that's not necessarily what Jennifer Haig is interested in. She's more interested about what does it mean to be, you know, a healthy sexual person.
Right, and able to enter into mature sexual relationships, mature relationships in general. Able to connect with somebody on an effective emotional level.
And that's something because Art, you write, a little piece you gave me beforehand, that he became a priest before he became a man. And that, in a lot of ways, tells you some of the problems that existed at the time because of the kind of unhealthy or immature sexuality among some of these priests. Let's switch to another parallel that you draw between Kath Conlon and Mary McGann, who is Sheila and Art's mother. Maybe you can introduce Kath to us.
Kath is a 27-year-old mother of a boy named Aiden, an 8-year-old. She's had a tough life. She's been all over the country. She was in California for a while. She stripped anything for money. She was in a long relationship with a guy who eventually wouldn't let her out of the apartment. She had to get out of it. She comes back home to her mom. She's on all sorts of drugs, OxyContin, anything she can get her hands on. She has a boyfriend that comes around when she's in the East Coast who's, you know, just a deadbeat, a punk. So she has tremendous problems. You know, she's struggling to raise her son. She's not the best mother. She leaves him at school a lot. And the kid is a sickly, sort of weak kid. But there's a parallel with Arthur's mother because when Arthur was an infant, his father disappeared. And it was him and his mother on their own. And his mother had to make do. And she was tough. She had to find a way for them to survive. Eventually, she had to find a husband in order for their, you know, somebody to sustain their lives, basically, somebody who could provide for them. So there is a parallel in sort of the strength of the two women and, you know, a wildness that was in Arthur's mother that disappeared after her marriage to Ted, Sheila and Michael's father.
Right, in the book, she's very much the old school, kind of very devout. She's very proud of her son, who's the priest. So you never think of her as kind of this wild soul, but that's what she was in before her marriage to Ted McGann. Maybe you can talk about another motif that runs through this book is light. You talk about water and now light. How does that play a role?
Well, toward the middle of the book, there's a scene where Sheila and Arthur are in Arthur's old rectory, and she's helping him move, get all his junk out of his rooms. And in the bedroom, she can't believe how dark it is there. And she pulls back the drapes, and there's a stained glass window. And on the window it says, "Ex umbra in solum," out of the shadows in the sun or into the light. So the whole process, the whole book is ex umbra in solum. It's a process of bringing the truth, light, out of darkness. All these things that nobody is willing to talk about in the McGann family are brought out. All the things that Arthur doesn't want to talk about in his own life are brought out. deep issues in Sheila's life are revealed and brought out, and she's forced to deal with them as she writes. Same with her brother Michael. Truths about his own marriage, brute honesty about his own life, his own happiness. The novel itself is that process to bring things out of the shadow into the light, so things could be healed, relationships could be strengthened, or improved with more honesty. So the whole novel is pulling, dragging stuff out of darkness into life, into light.
Now, I should ask, since you are from the New England province and grew up in Arlington, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston.
Actually, it's Arlington.
I'm sorry. You can tell that I'm from the Bronx. What did you make of some of the local color in this book?
Truthfully, the first 50, 70 pages, I quite disliked the book. There were a lot of things in it that were cookie-cutter Boston. Everybody's watching the Red Sox game. There's an allusion to the Blizzard of 78. It's like for a Bostonian who watches a Boston movie and hears all these fake, exaggerated Boston accents. I mean, I guess Jennifer Haag has moved to Hull, Mass., which is just south of Boston, and she's sort of immersed herself in the culture of Boston and is trying to get all these little hints of what life in Boston is like in, so, to make it authentic. Well, it becomes more like, walking into the Irish Cottage gift shop in a mall or something, and you're trying to look for authentic Irish. So that stuff is, off-putting. But, I mean, she's trying. She's trying to set the scene. It is absurd how many shamrocks you see in advertisements, how much green there is in advertisements around Boston, and Jimmy's, Sherbert, all these things rocketing through the South Shore suburbs on Route 3. So she gets it all in there. OFD, originally from Dorchester, all this stuff.
So some of it works, some of it doesn't. But in the end, as you write this, you were surprised where the novel left you. You started off with a little skepticism, but it kind of brought you a place you weren't expecting. And narratively, it really pulls you in. I read this in three or four sittings. I was surprised. It just rarely happens where I couldn't put it down at points.
Yeah, there is a draw. There is a curiosity that Haag builds in the reader to keep going. And it's not... It doesn't center upon the question whether or not Arthur is a child molester, whether or not he is guilty of abusing a young boy. It's more, how does this end? More and more layers of plot, of character development, but it's quick. It pulls you along, and it's quite emotional at the end. Quite emotional. I was surprised. And I likened it, as the image of the deep is very important throughout, I liken it, well, and plus we're talking about the South Shore and just south of Boston, the beach. I liken it to, sometimes a good story picks you up like a wave and tosses you, and you get deposited somewhere with, sand in your trunks on the beach, 20 feet away from where you tried to enter the water. And this is exactly what this novel does. It sort of lifts you up and deposits you someplace else. It's a good story.
It is a good story, and I found it very affecting, especially the end. And part of me really wants to talk about that ending to kind of break it down, but we won't do that for our listeners. Maybe we'll have a second podcast a few months from now. But we want to thank Kevin Spinelli for coming to join us.
Thank you, Tim.